Hello again, and welcome to Global Exchange, part of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute's podcast network. I'm your host and Vice President of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Colin Robertson. On this episode, we look at multilateralism with Ambassador Tom Pickering and Admin Trivedi. Tom Pickering is Vice Chair of Hills & Company and served for more than four decades as a U.S. diplomat, including as Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs and Ambassador to the United Nations. He was also Ambassador to Jordan, Nigeria, El Salvador, Israel, India, and Russia. On his retirement, he is one of the few American diplomats to be designated as career ambassador. Admin Trivedi is Managing Director of Hills & Company and Adjunct Fellow at the Pacific Forum. Ambassador Pickering and Admin, welcome to the Global Exchange.
Thank you.
Some context for listeners. Ambassador Pickering and Admin have written a piece for Foreign Affairs magazine. Their piece is titled, quote, "The International Order Didn't Fail the Pandemic Alone," unquote, and the link will be on our website. I encourage you to read it. Tom and Admin argue that in dealing with the COVID pandemic, the key multilateral organizations, the UN Security Council, the G7, the G20, and the lead functional organization, the World Health Organization, have been disappointing. They have either failed to act or been slow to act. In the case of the WHO, the World Health Organization, there have also been accusations that politics got in the way of health. But this is important, as Ambassador Pickering and Admin argue, quote, "To blame such vulnerabilities on a lack of effort or expertise in the institutions themselves mistakes the symptoms for the cause. At the heart of the problem is the failure of the world's leading powers, starting with the United States and China, to invest in and empower the multilateral system. Washington's sins of omission and Beijing's sins of commission have conspired to sideline international institutions, helping frustrate their common goal of ending the pandemic." Unquote. Tom, is multilateralism finished?
No, it's not, but it's at a very low period. And the fact that the big players in the world, the five permanent members of the Security Council, but particularly China, the U.S., and Russia, are in fact putting themselves in opposition to using the Security Council, the G20, the G7, as instruments for making foreign policy progress and cooperation, has meant that multilateralism has slid quite a long way from where it had been and where I think all people of wisdom and good sense would like to see it go. And the pandemic raises that in the starkest possible way, because what happens in one country is going to happen in another country. The pandemic has no passport, no visa requirements, and knows no boundaries.
Appen, do you want to come in on this?
Right. We've talked about the political vulnerabilities of multilateral organizations as being very real, but they're essential to respond effectively to the health and economic impacts of the pandemic, as Tom just laid out. It's also important, not to lose sight of what these organizations have done well. You take the World Health Organization, which has been much maligned, and people like President Trump may be right that the WHO was initially too trusting of China, but we also shouldn't lose sight of the WHO's significance in fighting the pandemic thus far. Things like over a dozen U.S. experts were at WHO headquarters providing real-time data about what was happening in December and January, even if that was limited, about the virus's discovery and spread in China. Senior U.S. scientists traveled to Wuhan with the WHO in February to collect information. And so while these organizations are imperfect and they've been sluggish in some instances, they still have a critical role, and we shouldn't lose sight of the positive impact that they're making in spite of some of the dysfunction among the major powers.
So, Admin, you'd say reform them, don't rubbish them, because as you correctly point out, first of all, there's not really anything alternative. And while there may be shortcomings that you've also identified, overall, this is still the best approach.
Yeah, let me jump in here with one point. People are not aware of the fact in general that WHO is an organization established by a separate treaty. The members of the international community, all 194 of them, are all members of the WHO. They all agreed when they set up the WHO, the WHO would rely on the data provided by member states. The WHO, interestingly enough, doesn't have an independent data collection and data investigation responsibility and depends on the member states. So what China was telling the WHO was what the WHO charter said it had to work with. How much it doubted that may be a weakness, but one of the things we could do is straighten out that particular responsibility under the charter and empower the WHO to do investigations of data and analysis of data on a way that enshrines a great deal more of independence on the basis of science and health consideration.
And Tom, there are precedents for that. Are there things like the International Atomic Energy Commission go in and investigate? Is that sort of what you're thinking, that you give them this investigative capacity, assuming that the membership agrees at their annual assemblies, which would potentially strengthen their hands?
It would, and it would be a general assertion of capacity on the part of the WHO. The IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, derives its investigative policies from specific treaty commitments and from subsidiary agreements under the treaty that set it up, that authorize it in connection with international atomic energy cooperation, in fact, to establish and to carry out safeguards, inspection mechanisms to be sure the nuclear information is not being in any way used for military purposes.
But this idea that you're putting forward of empowering organizations, it could be the Food and Agriculture Organization, because as we become more connected, challenges will increase. This may be one, because we always try, as I say, we try to, what can we do to fix things? This would be something that would be a sort of another piece in the arsenal of the, in this case, the World Health Organization.
But, Colin, it would be particularly important to understand that everybody joined that organization to assure that the world got the best health care possible. So whatever stands in the way of the world getting the best health care possible is standing in the way of the declared objectives of the countries who became members of that organization, China included. And the notion that data and information can be held back for domestic political concerns in a scientific and health issue is something we ought to need now get over. And we all know, because of the impact of the COVID virus right now, we have perhaps the most leverage, if someone would take a lead, in making that happen.
Appen, you make the point, and I sort of quoted the idea of the sins of omission and sins of commission, the sins of omission on the part of the Trump administration, but is that sort of not inevitable when you put America first? And this whole multilateral system, as we're learning, is hard to sustain if the architect and driver, the protector, the guardian of it, is not committed to it, as we're currently, unfortunately, experiencing with the current U.S. administration. Is that fair?
That's absolutely right, Colin. You know, when you have the world's wealthiest and most powerful nation setting the wrong example, you know, that limits the art of the possible in trying to tackle a common enemy with a shared common set of solutions. The existing U.S. administration's approach, as you noted, America First, focuses on advancing American interests and sees that advancement as kind of a zero-sum pursuit. For the U.S. to get ahead, that may necessarily mean others have to fall behind. And that makes it very hard to bring our partners, allies together. It's an invitation to double down on self-help. And I think other countries could be getting the wrong message. Take India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi. In a rare nationally televised address earlier this month, he focused on the need for the Indian people and for the Indian government to turn to self-reliance. The U.S. historically hasn't only led by example, but it's convened and orchestrated global responses to global problems, whether it was the Ebola epidemic in 2014 in West Africa, or it was the Obama administration helping bring the world together at Copenhagen to arrive at a common approach on climate change. And the sins of omission that we refer to in the context of the U.S. is the administration being absent from attempts to mobilize international action against the pandemic. you could argue that its most conspicuous contribution internationally has been finger pointing about the disease's origins. And that's just not going to cut it. And so we're seeing references to G6 and the G19, unfortunately, without the U.S. And in the process, that just cedes influence to China, who we know has a political system and an approach that's very different than ours. And so here in Washington, the November presidential election will present an opportunity for a reset when it comes to renewed American leadership in the world.
Two quick points on what I thought Adman had said so well. One is, as an American, America first, in my view, means doing everything that you possibly can to safeguard the interests and the health of Americans. The fact that we're pursuing a policy which in one way or another allows this disease to spread all around the world without leadership and without coordination, and in effect promotes hoarding and promotes the notion that if you can pay for it, you can outstrip everybody else in getting what it is you need to take care of your people and forget the fact that it comes over the borders. And I think that's significant. Secondly, and Adman made this point, but let me strengthen the point a little bit. The American election is coming up. Unfortunately, Trump's total preoccupation is whatever he can do with China, with the WHO, to do everything he can to take away his terrible handling of how the virus has been dealt with by him at the federal level in the United States. And so China as a new enemy, the WHO somehow as a failed instrument, have in one way or another been used on the Twitter account and elsewhere as ways to contest the next American election. Again, at the expense, unfortunately, I believe, of the people of America and of the people of the world. And this is not the best of what I believe the United States was organized for and the way it's conducted itself. Now, that sounds highly political, but in this day and age, we can't avoid the fact that politics in one way or another is being used to intrude on science and the value that science brings us in the best possible ways to proceed. And as you know, we are going back to work in this country in a number of cases in places where we have bent the guidelines or put the guidelines on the side in the hope that we will not have a further attack of the first wave, much less a second wave. And these are important considerations, and I think they need to be looked at. And you're our neighbors. You're certainly among our very best neighbors in the fact that what we do here is going to affect you and vice versa is something that we should not put aside lightly.
Tom, as an out, sort of looking at somebody who's been personally committed to multilateralism, as are you, you look at what's going on. The United States, as I said at the outset, is kind of the guardian, but this was a consistent policy followed by Democrats and Republicans, and it was that the departure of the Trump administration is unsettling and unsettling multilateralism. But you also come away with the impression that without the United States, multilateralism cannot succeed. You know, others, Lindsay and Ivo Dalder, have said, well, you know, we could have a kind of, we'll bring together the others in the Democrat in the G20, or we'll be another like-minded group. But my observation would be, and I'd be interested in how you see this, is that without the United States, it doesn't work. And a piece of that is because I don't think the Chinese have the same view of multilateralism that successive U.S. administrations have shared. They've been more sort of takers and users rather than defenders of the system. So I've thrown a lot at you. I'd be interested in your response.
Well, Madeleine Albright once hooked herself to the fact that without the United States, it wouldn't work. I don't take that view, but I take the view that people have been so used to having the U.S. take leadership that in the period since Trump has been engaged, the habit is still to say to themselves, one, what does the United States think? Two, what does that mean for us? Three, we need to convince the United States to go in a way that could be helpful to us, despite the fact that the U.S. has downed tools or shuffled it aside or in one way or another aimed itself in another direction. But there is no four. What is it that we can do ourselves as members of the international community to pull together enough of a cohesive way of proceeding? So we are in a situation where there is studied disaggregation. In some ways, this suits China, which would, I think, like to aggregate as much of what I would call influence at this day and age, that's a diplomatic way of saying power, to itself. And so we're playing a game which in many ways loses the value of cooperation, coalition building, and multilateralism, to turning what's left of it over to other people and the hopes that that can work, and three, losing sight of the fact that the successes the world has achieved have been without a shred of doubt on the basis of the degree to which international cooperation toward a common objective can be achieved, put together, and used, whether it was in war fighting or whether it is in peace building.
Edmund, I want to come to you on this one because Tom, I think, asked the right questions. And his fourth question is, okay, what can you do that is the rest of the world, or at least the democracies, to help? And it's been a consistent thread of Americans, particularly on the defense and security file. You think of Robert Gates' elegant valedictory at NATO when he said, look, Americans are fed up with carrying this. You, the rest of the world, have to do more. Is that a piece in all this that to repair multilateralism, the like-minded, those who truly are committed to multilateralism, are going to have to step up more?
Oh, absolutely so. I think in part for the reason that you mentioned, Colin, that the non-like-minded, if you will, the China and Russia, they lack the muscle memory. They tend to take a more narrow view of their interests and more of an a la carte approach to multilateralism. You know, China has shown a willingness to work together when it's in their interest. They work with us and the G20 to help prevent the Great Recession from becoming the Great Depression in 2008 and 2009. But there, in other instances, they've rejected international law and they haven't wanted to have conversations jointly in a multilateral setting, most prominently in the South China Sea context. And so everyone is going to need to pitch in. And I think that starts with the European Union and its member states, France and Germany in particular, countries like Canada and Australia, and certainly the longtime linchpin for the liberal international order in Asia, Japan, will also have to lead. And so I think it's going to take, you know, more from these countries stepping forward. But we're seeing some positive signs as of late. The European Union led an international effort a couple of weeks ago to raise funds to finance pandemic response, including therapeutics and a vaccine. The United States wasn't present, and China contributed nothing financially. But the Europeans and Japan, who has played a leading role in Asia in defense of international rules, norms to keep markets open, moving forward with the CPTPP. This is the regional trade agreement. Even when the Trump administration withdrew at the outset in January of 2017, so there are efforts underway to defend traditional, well-established rules and norms. But we're going to need to see Europe and Japan, other democracies, step forward. One interesting idea that's been put out along these lines is Vice President Biden has proposed convening a summit of democracies, having an annual meeting where like-minded countries come together, both to fortify themselves, but then to explore how to work together to advance liberal norms. Certainly, there would be a need with the world in the midst of the virus, but there are also other significant crises out there that need to be addressed as well, including climate change, where like-minded countries may be able to work together.
So, Tom, as one, if you sort of follow through what Edmund's saying, the like-minded, I remember John McCain telling me years ago about the idea of he had for a League of Democracies, feeling that the UN had become paralyzed. And I think it's worth pointing out to listeners that while the current challenges to multilateralism are probably as significant as they've ever been, there have always been challenges, and part of it, of course, is multilateralism is only as strong as all the players are willing to make it, and especially if it depends on consensus. So if that consensus can't be reached, do we have to kind of go back to basics and look at groupings which have been suggested on trade and on some of these other issues of a new configuration of like-minded democracies, for example?
It's a very good question, Colin, and I would say there are a couple of things that I think need to be put forward in that regard. I think for trade, we've said for health and for many other things, I believe very much we need to strengthen the institutions we have rather than tear them up and start anew. Secondly, we need to begin to deal with these problems, many of them clearly unresolvable without broad international cooperation, at a time when two things are happening that are very important. One is the struggle, if you could call it this way, for international leadership. And certainly China is a major player on the scene, and how we deal with China and how we work with China, and I think it's not the way that Trump is doing it, but I think is very significant and very important in pulling things together, because for China and the United States, the most important thing is to resolve catastrophes that could happen if we're not together, whether that is the very malign and deleterious effects of not dealing effectively with climate change. Certainly, important question of how can we deal best with pandemics as they come along. The notion that we weren't going to have any more was really quite prevalent before. But there's a political question here that is also significant, and that's a world of multipolar leadership rather than necessarily hegemonic or single state leadership, something that many people in the United States believed we actually had, although I never thought that in international actions we could get major questions resolved on our own, by ourselves, without the help of coalitions, friends, and allies. It was an axiom of U.S. policy during the Cold War that it was friends and allies. In the post-Cold War period, we let some of that slide, but even then it was known to be much more important in making things work. There's a big agenda out there, as I think Atman has laid out very, very well for us, and almost all of those things in one way or another are going to involve leadership. So we're coming up to November in 2020. One could certainly hope that there will be a new administration that will pay attention to this. We'll look at it as a new opportunity. We'll attempt to rebuild some of it, but we'll also take into account some of these changes that we've all mentioned, the growth and scope of the multilateral changes, the necessity for dealing with a multipolar leadership question in the world, the necessity for taking existential threats, whether they're nuclear war and nuclear weapons, or the climate change question, or others, into account, and the importance to the big powers of being able to get that right, and the notion that they can't get that right unilaterally on their own, hunkering down in their borders, dissing everybody else, taking advantage of international weakness for a situation in which America first or China first means climbing on the back of everybody else to a position of ascendancy without recognizing the enormous dangers and changes that will take place as a result of doing that, to say nothing of creating a coalition of the international community in exactly the opposite direction. All things that are possible now and all things we need to look at.
Tom, if we'd had this conversation 30 years ago, when we haven't talked about this country yet, we would have talked about Russia. Where does Russia fit in all of this? You know, they're still powerfully, as you well know, this, I know the work you've been doing in terms of arms control and nuclear proliferation. Where do you see the Russians? You've been there, you know the country. Are they a constructive force, or are we simply under Mr. Putin dealing with another kind of renegade state, revanchist power?
It's a great question, and my own view is that there are elements of what you've had to say, both sides, in dealing with Russia. The other day I counted off 6 or 8 things that we were still cooperating with Russia to get done because both of us wanted to get done, despite the fact that they receive no publicity and are pretty much in a number of ways at the back end of world consideration. But there are things like acting together in intelligence on terrorism that are important. There is space cooperation, where we depended on Russia for the last dozen years to get to the space station. We're trying to go on our own now, but in some ways that space station will be a point of international cooperation for the future to come. And there will be others. The Russians are in many ways being ravaged, not just by the virus, but by a growth in drug and narcotics cases inside Russia, which are hurting. Mr. Putin, in many ways, has become the man who takes advantage of every opportunity to stop things in order to demonstrate his power on the world scene. China is adopting some of those approaches to international activities. We should be the first in standing out against those, and we should be the first in using the leverage that we have to begin to pull Russia and China together. In many cases, Russia is a much weaker state in many ways, but its power of being able to block, not the least of which is through its veto in the UN Security Council, is something that has made a mess, if I could put it this way, of the capacity of the United Nations Security Council to do the job it's supposed to do, deal with threats to peace and security, and a situation in which all but I think a number of second-order questions is somehow thrown into the dustbin right now. And that's a serious mistake, because these will come back to bite people in one way or another in the future. But without the kind of significant committed American leadership, the use of ideas, diplomacy, the fact that we can find ways in many circumstances to talk to the Russians about our common need to have a common sense of cooperation, and the same goes for China, is a failure in the international system to use multilateralism. And my final word on this is the U.S. in the Second World War spent a great deal of time with a number of other countries figuring out a way to repair the mistakes and the foibles of the League of Nations. And it was a foreign policy victory, and it was a foreign policy instrument of great power and of great capacity. It has never worked perfectly. The Cold War was very dangerous and very damaging. We need to take a look to see what we can do about that. And one of the big questions I've always had in mind is the veto in the Security Council should be much more qualified in its use than it is now. And there was a time at the end of the Cold War, when I happened to have been in New York in 1989, 1990, when I think we could have made some real progress in that, but we never did, because in fact there were other pressing circumstances that took it away. But the opportunity will open up. It may be the tragedy of the virus and the mayhem that it's created, and it's scything through the populations of the international community, will give us a new chance to say, maybe this is now something else on which we have a real existential dependence on cleaning up.
To which I would simply say amen. And then I want to put question to you then, Atman, to sort of, because in your paper you say that, because at the heart, I think, of the multilateral system remains the United Nations, and of course the Security Council is critical in that. You suggest that the UN Security Secretary General should authorize an independent panel of outside experts to review the lessons learned, a bit like Tom has sort of sketched some of that. Is that what we need to do, not just for the UN, but basically to look at other organizations like the WHO and anything else, the World Trade Organization, because there's a whole set of international organizations on which that form the skeleton of the multilateral system, but are under a lot of pressure and criticism right now. Do we need to do kind of a root and branch aimed at coming up with how we're going to make them work better?
I do think that we do need to do some reflection. These institutions are coming under assault and a lot of criticism. And as Tom and I argue in the piece, much of it has to do more with symptoms rather than causes of the problem. And the symptoms in question here are major power rivalry between Russia and China, of course, and their inability to work together, and the inward focus of both countries. But there probably should be some accounting of lessons learned and best practices developed so far, because we don't know how long the virus is going to be with us. COVID-19 could be with us for many years, unfortunately. We could be facing a second wave. We know the 1918 flu, the second wave resulted in the most devastation. And so we have to rapidly learn, what has worked well internationally, where are opportunities for growth, and where can these organizations be strengthened? And at the same time, look at best practices on a national basis, but do it in a spirit not of waging a blame game, but trying to identify what lessons can we learn and how do they apply to the situation we're facing. Now, this can't be sort of a 9/11 style review of what went wrong. Here in the U.S., we had a September 11th commission looking at those terrible terrorist attacks that did a root and branch review of and accounting of everything. We need something that's more rapid and can give us input and feedback in a timely way, but also importantly, something that is devoid of corrosive national politics and corrosive nationalisms that you see animating some of these calls to look at the origins of the coronavirus and who is to blame and who did what, when, where, and why. That's counterproductive and self-defeating and counter to the spirit of understanding that there is a common good here and we need to find ways collectively to deal with a shared problem in the pandemic.
All right. Well, I encourage listeners to read the piece in Foreign Affairs. There'll be a link to it on our website that Edmund and Tom Pickering have written. Edmund, let me start with you. What are you reading these days?
I'm reading a book about U.S. diplomacy following the end of the Cold War. It's by a diplomat who Tom knows very well, Ambassador Bill Burns, and it charts American diplomacy over the last few decades, some of the stumbles, such as the Iraq 2003 war, and it makes the case for the renewal of diplomacy in the United States.
Oh, hear, hear to that. Tom, what are you reading?
I'm reading Susan Rice's book called Tough Love. And it's very interesting. I've known Susan, worked with her, not fantastically closely. I appear in the book. I have to admit that. So that may question my objectivity. But in many ways, it's a personal memoir of power. In many significant ways, in the enormous personal problem she faced in her upbringing going through a very difficult family experience of breakup, which is in its own way heartening and something I knew nothing about, but very open, very honest, very straightforward. It's a strong sense of her personal commitment to the things that she thinks is right, and I'm now engaged in her work in running the National Security Council, all of which was extremely interesting. And I would suggest it's an interesting book to get a glimpse into the life of someone who has done extraordinarily well in the American government and political system and whose views and attitudes were, I think, very important in that, and whose capacity to admit mistakes and foibles, not an easy part of government life, is clearly balanced with her great respect, particularly for President Obama, and her great respect for the American process.
Oh, hear, hear to that. I'm a big fan of Susan. When I was posted in Washington, her husband, as you know, is Canadian. She very kindly invited my wife and I over to her house, and just being at that house and meeting the people that she knew. She was at Brookings at the time, and her hard but tough analysis was very useful. So I look forward to the book, which I haven't read. I've just read some of the reviews, but thank you for raising that. Well, thanks for listening to this episode of The Global Exchange. We were joined today by Ambassador Thomas Pickering, Edmund Trivedi. You can link to their foreign affairs piece through our website. Remember, you can find the CJAI Network on iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. If you'd like the show, give us a rating. You can also find the Canadian Global Affairs Institute on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Global Exchange is brought to you by our team at CJAI. Thanks go to producer Jay Rankin and to Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Colin Robertson. Thanks for joining us today on the Global Exchange.